Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And before we get to this episode, I want to talk to you about the Cambridge Footlights. Now, the Cambridge Footlights are embarking on a world tour, and they are proud to present their biggest show of the year, Lagoon, which will be hitting the brand new Blackout Cabaret at the Second City Training Center in Chicago on September 14th. Now, if you haven't heard of the Cambridge Footlights, they boast such former members as John Oliver, John Cleese, Emma Thompson. For tickets, visit the Second City website and use the code NERD for $2 off. And here is a message to all those coffee drinkers out there that is always looking for the next big cup of joe. Well, I got it right here, and it's called Rhetoric Coffee. And Rhetoric Coffee is a subscription coffee service that sends you amazing, freshly roasted coffee. And each roast is completely unique. You won't taste these complex flavors anywhere else. And here's the coolest part. They commission original art directly from some of the coolest comic book artists out there, and they hand screen them on each bag. You get like a mini work of art. Now, you're going to feel good, not only because it tastes so good and you've got a piece of art in your apartment or your house. They go beyond fair trade, not just with the coffee, but with the artists. Now, if you go to rhetoriccoffee.com, that's rhetoriccoffee.com, and that's spelled R-H-E-T-O-R-I-C, and enter the promo code IMPROV, you will get 30% off. That's 30% off your first order. And, of course, don't forget, if you like what we're doing here at Improv Nerd, if you like these interviews, if you like what I've been doing here, please, I'm begging you, go to iTunes and like us. Not for yourself, do it for me, my low self-esteem. It really would help. Okay, we have got a great episode of Improv Nerd for you, but when do we don't? Think about it. We never have a bad episode of Improv Nerd, and this is no exception. Our guest today is one of my favorite stand-ups. He is hilarious, Marty DeRosa. He is the co-host of the hilarious podcast, Marty and Sarah Love Wrestling. You got to check this out because they are improvising characters and it's just so funny. Even if you don't like wrestling, you're going to love that podcast. It's that freaking funny. He also does a podcast, which I was lucky to be a part of. It surprises you that I'd love this podcast. It's called Wrestling with Depression. And I got to talk. It was actually two episodes that I talked about. My depression, my ongoing depression, but you guys have heard enough about that. We talked to Marty about losing a sibling and a parent early in his life, also his father, and how he improvises with the audience when he does stand-up. He's got a great approach. He's got an improvisational approach to stand-up comedy, so you're really going to like that. But before we get to this episode, you need to know a little something about this episode. I invited Marty. I've known Marty for a while. I love Marty. He's so honest. He's so revealing. I feel like we're brothers. There's some sort of connection going on there. And so I invited him to my house to do this podcast. And Marty is a professional. He is a total pro. He's done a lot of podcasts. He's done a lot of broadcasting stuff. He's just very good. And so we sat down and we did an hour interview. It was over an hour. It was brilliant. It was great. And I'm an idiot, as you know, and I did not plug in the computer, so it stopped right in the middle of it. And I'm no big deal. I thought it, you know, I went back and it was gone. It was gone. That hour and 10 minutes of brilliance from Marty DeRosa, I lost. So of course, you know me, I'm feeling anger, right? I'm feeling shame, and I'm so pissed at myself. And that's the hardest thing when you do something like that, where there's no one else to blame. You know, look, I couldn't blame Lauren. I certainly couldn't blame Marty. It was me, all me, which makes it really hard. And I'm trying to be as professional as I can, feeling that I'm not a professional because I did the most amateur thing you could do. And that is, you know, record something and then lose it. So Marty, because he's a professional, he agreed to re-record it. We were supposed to just go for a half hour, just hit the highlights of the interview we had done before. And I want to say something. I think this interview, that last interview was great, but I think this one is even better. So here it is. You're going to love this. This guy, I love this guy. I cannot say enough about him. Here it is, the Marty DeRosa episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Marty DeRosa, thank you so much for re-recording this episode of Improv Nerd.
I still think... Yes. That the tech gods will find the episode that we did, mm-hmm. And that'll I don't think it's lost.
Can you tell the listener what happened? Because I'm devastated. I feel shame. I feel anger.
It's okay.
Let's talk about depression.
Yeah, I think I don't know. Your computer ran out of juice, mm-hmm. and that was it.
Yeah,
we lost the episode.
Yeah, I didn't. I had charged it up.
Yeah,
and thought I had enough time, and I didn't have an extension cord, so it just quit on us.
Uh-huh.
Over an hour. Really great stuff.
I thought selfishly, I thought it was pretty good too.
Marty, it was outstanding. It was outstanding.
I thought it was good. I told you stuff I haven't told anybody ever, and I may never tell again. No, I think you'll find it. I think some 14-year-old kid will come over and hit a button, and you'll go, "Oh, there it is." And I'll go, "Oh, who are these guys whining about comedy?"
Any advice for me who's filled with shame, filled with just feels shitty. I feel bad keeping you here.
It's okay.
To get through the rest of this interview.
Advice?
Yes.
To you?
Yes, to me. Cause
to just where it's I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here. Let's keep talking. We're buddies.
Okay.
It's okay. We're here.
You grew up in Indiana.
I did.
Your mother and sister both died when you were 21.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about
my my sister drowned on vacation in Costa Rica, and
do you remember when you heard that?
Yeah, I was in the city, living in Indiana, but I was in Chicago, going to a Real Big Fish concert, which is a ska band that I loved as a teenager, and we were visiting a friend who was in a real bad car accident. In Indiana, and in Indiana, when you get in bad car accidents, I was one of them. I have a scar on my head. Where is it?
I see it.
Right here.
It looks like you had like maybe 14 stitches.
Yeah, I had I put my head through a windshield driving. I fell asleep. Shouldn't have been driving. And I fell asleep and put my head through the windshield, and they took me to the hospital. And they were like, this was in Jasper County, Indiana, and they were like, "Well, we can't help him." I was in a coma, so I got airlifted to Loyola. Which is in Chicago. So I woke up in Chicago, and I was like, "Ooh, I thought I was arrested and in trouble and all this stuff." But that's what happens in Indiana. You get if you're really hurt, they have to take you to Chicago. So this girl I knew, she was at Northwestern. We were gonna visit her, then we were gonna go to the concert. And this is how old I am. I had a beeper at the time, because all cool kids did.
Right.
All cool.
What did you need a beeper for?
I mean, to meet up with friends and to, you know, have fun. I needed a beeper. So
was that a big thing in Indiana?
Sure. Okay. Huge thing. If you had a beeper, you were cool. You had codes for everything. This meant this.
So like
meant
a 989 meant something.
Sure. Everything meant something. Okay. Sure. Everything meant something. And I kept getting page after page after page to call my house. It was just like, you know, and I think my parents liked me having a beeper too, so they can be like, "Hey, we paged you, you didn't call," or whatever. So I remember calling home and them saying, "You need to come home." And I was like, "Why? I'm ready to go to this concert. Like, I don't want to come home. I'm going to a concert. Like, why? Like, you just need to come home." I kept thinking I was in trouble because of my accident. I got sued, luckily, you know, through my dad's auto insurance, or I was under his insurance or whatever. Like, it all got taken care of, but... At the time, I was like thinking like, "Oh, they're gonna charge me with a DUI or something, like retroactively, or I'm gonna get in some trouble for something." And I was like, "Am I in trouble?" And they're like, "Just come home." And then I started to think like, maybe I'm not in trouble. And then for some reason I asked if it was either my sister, did something happen to my sister, or did something happen to my nephew? I thought something might have happened to him. And they were like, "Just come home. We're not saying anything." And then I was kind of like, "Something's up." So my friends were like, "We need to take you home. Like, something's clearly up. Like, you need to go home." So we drove home instead of going to the concert at the, I think it was the House of Blues. We drove home, and it was one of those things where...
What are you thinking on that car ride home?
We're worst case scenarioing it. Okay, what if it's this? What if it's this? And it's, of course, no one's going to be like, what if someone died? Like, people are like, you're fine. You're probably, you know what I mean? Like, maybe the cops are going to charge you with something. Or then I'm always paranoid too. I'm like, maybe they found something in my room or something. Like, what could they have found? And I didn't know. My mind was wandering. And I think my friends were also just, you know, 20-year-old dudes who were just kind of like, who cares? I think they, like, 21. I think they dropped me off. Like, we're going to the bar or something like that.
So you weren't driving from Chicago to Indiana with beer in the car?
No. So we were ready to – they dropped me off. And I remember, too, they dropped me off. They didn't, like, stay or anything because I think they thought, like, I was in trouble. They were like, fuck this. We're out of here. Like, my dad was a pretty intimidating guy.
Were you a guy who got in a lot of trouble?
I got out of a lot of trouble.
Okay.
I got out of a lot of trouble. Every once in a while, I'd get in trouble. But we did some dumb stuff. One summer, we stole a Rolex and sold it on the south side and had, like, a couple grand and just spent it like idiots all summer. And then finally our parents were like, what is going on? And then the girl who gave us the Rolex, like, told on it. It was her stepdad's, and she hated him, and we got busted.
Where'd you sell it? Like, at a pawn shop?
Yeah. And I had one of those friends who, like, knew how to maneuver around the underworld, so it's kind of, we got in a lot of trouble. But we got out of a lot of trouble.
Whatever happened to that guy?
He does, like, computer stuff for, I think, like, some charity that, like, Gary Sinise has something to do with or something.
I had a friend like that, and he always turned out to be, they either go to prison or they become the most successful.
Yep. So, that would be great. Like, his name is Mark Zuckerberg. Might have heard of him. But
little thing called Facebook.
Yeah, so they're dropping me off, and I remember this because, like, when they were dropping me off, every light was on in my house. And
what time of...
I was probably getting home, like, around 9, and, like, every light was on. And I remember being like, you know, like, that wasn't a normal thing. I'm like, my house is lit up, and my brother's now wife, but then ex-girlfriend, her truck was out in front. And it was like, what the fuck is she doing here? And I'm starting to go, oh, something's, you know what I mean? Like, all that was missing was, like, police tape and cop cars. Like, something clearly was going on in this house. Right. And my brother's in the front yard and or, like, by the front door. And I remember I get out and I'm walking up the driveway. And then my mom just came out and she was like, Maura, that was my sister's name. She's like, Maura's dead. She died. And I just dropped. That whole thing of, like, people being like, it was like I got the wind knocked out of me. It's like, yep, that's how it is.
Were you on the floor crying?
Yeah. I dropped to my knees and I was crying. And it was like a combo of, like, I just couldn't believe what happened. And I remember that night I was watching, like, Behind the Music about, like, Lenny Kravitz or something. And, like, you remember those weird things. Then I remember sitting on the front porch with my brother and there was a cop. And we lived in a cul-de-sac, and he was circling real slow, and I think he put the light on us or whatever, and I was like, fuck off, or what the fuck do you want, or something like that, or we can't sit on our own fucking porch or something, and he's like, what have you guys been doing all night? And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And then, like, I think my brother was just like, we're having a very bad night with our family. Like, we had a loss in the family or whatever. And the cop was just like, said something stupid or whatever. And I was like, so angry.
What changes for you at that point? Here you are, 21, drinking a lot.
Well, one of the things we talked about before that got, or maybe not erased, put aside for now.
I hope.
I now lost the opportunity to kill myself if I needed to.
Well, had you had suicidal thoughts up to that point?
Yeah.
When was your first suicidal thought?
Now we're getting into a whole nother. This is a whole new chapter we've opened up.
Well, that's good.
I sexually as a kid, weird experiment kid, and always, you know, finding out new ways to play with myself or whatever. I honestly thought that, and I do a bit about this, where I thought that the tip of my penis, I thought it was supposed, the tip of the penis, I thought was supposed to go all the way around, like a mushroom cap.
Okay.
And I thought that what I used to do is I used to rub myself on pillows. Mm-hmm. That was how I would masturbate as a kid.
Right.
I thought that I had eroded my penis by doing that. And as a kid, I had heard that when we get into high school, we have to shower together. Mm-hmm. And I was like, fuck, they're all going to find out. And I was like, I'll kill myself before that so no one will be able to make fun of me about it. That was literally, I literally thought that. Until one day I saw a movie and I was like, oh, great. I don't have to kill myself.
And then then your mom dies.
Then my mom dies. So that my sister died on the 3rd of July. Because I remember the 4th of July, my friends were like, well, we're having a party. And I was like, I don't know if I want to go to a party, you know. But I went and I remember feeling so weird and just being like, I'm going to go home. But
is this the beginning of self-medicating yourself?
No. I was self-medicating before that.
What were you doing?
Everything. Everything but heroin.
So pot?
Sure.
Booze?
Sure.
Cocaine?
Sure.
And when
mushrooms, acid. Those
how young were you starting to do this?
16, I would say, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And then really hit my stride junior year of high school, like really got into like psychedelics and mushrooms and acid every weekend, and loved it. Just loved it.
What'd you love about it?
That I didn't have to think. I was with my buddies. They were the funniest people I ever knew. And it was just like, this is great. This is so great. A big depression hit when everybody started going off to college and that little core group kind of broke up. And college is a time where depression kicks in for a lot of people because you're out of your routine. You know, you're out of your routine. There's new people, there's new things, your old habits are broken and stuff like that. So that really hit me. But my sister passed away 3rd of July, and then the following April, my mom had breast cancer. It was in remission. I think after my sister passed away, my mom was never the same. Like, and I think she knew she was dying, and there are certain things she did or didn't do that were kind of like, she must have known. You know, and when it came back in her liver, I was living in Milwaukee at the time. I transferred to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I have no idea why nobody was just like, you probably should just stay home. But they were like, this might be good for you or whatever. And it was one of the worst years of my life. It was up there.
What was your family always concerned about you? Like,
yes and no. Like, I think that there was always some concern. But I think also I was good enough as a bullshitter to be like, I'm great. And they're like, okay. And I think my dad would always use the term, like, we always thought you'd figure it out. Or we'd hope you'd figure it out.
Because you were probably a smart kid.
I was a smart kid, and I was, you know, Ferris Bueller-y enough to, like, get by things.
But never applied himself at school.
Never. I would always have the teacher be like, I don't understand. Like, you seem smart. You seem like you can do this or whatever. And then I would get the test and be like, what the fuck is all of this? I don't know. And I clearly had, like, ADHD and depression and all, and it all went unmedicated or unfit, this and that, and then some other childhood stuff that went on that I was, you know, I would shake my head and I had some weird, like, what happened with that? We had a couple weird situations and things like that I was kind of like, I would get the runaround from my parents. Oh, I don't know about all that.
You're a big proponent of therapy,
yeah,
and medication and all that?
Not necessarily Medicaid, but therapy and medication if it's right for that person.
Okay. Were your parents seeking out help for you when you were younger?
On and off. But I think I was, and I think I was like, I knew enough to be like, oh, I'm good. I'll, you know, I just need to focus and stuff on school and not mess around. And they'd be like, okay, like, give us your word. I got away with way more than I should have, because I was the youngest. My brother was 10 years older than me, my sister 7. My parents thought they were done having kids, so they had me when they were like 42. So they were just kind of like checked out a little bit, I think. And my brother and sister were both very good kids. Like, I think my brother, like, throughout high school got drunk like once. I remember he got drunk and fell and like split his lip and had to get stitches. And that was like the only time he ever drank. And I was like coming home on acid, like, you know, every weekend. So I don't think they were prepared to sort of handle me. Like, I think other parents were like, oh, you're a wild one. Like, we need to watch out for you. And And I like that too. I don't know why I like that. I like that people knew I was real wild and growing up, and maybe the attention or whatever. And then, but my parents were either oblivious or they were just kind of like, well, we don't know, it doesn't hurt us or something like that. So then, yeah, my mom had passed away, and I went to Milwaukee after my sister passed away. And then while I was there, my dad, you know, I heard my mom was sick again. And then I was like, I remember kept saying, like, do I need to come home? I think I just wanted to come home. I'd come home all the time anyway, but I was like, do I need to come home? And he'd be like, no. Do I need to come home? No. And then finally it's like, yeah, I think you need to come home. She was at Northwestern. And the idea was, you know, she was kind of going to do like a, I don't even know, maybe like a hospice type of thing or something where, you know, we'd have a nurse that would be staying at the house and we were going to get like one of those like hospital beds. And we were like, all right, we'll put it in the living room and this and that. And we were like planning everything. And then like 2 days later, she died.
And how'd you take that news after your sister had just died?
It was like the two different sides of the coin where with my sister, it was like she just went on vacation and never came home. So there wasn't a lot of closure there. We weren't super close at all either because she kind of was like, you're a bullshitter, you're fucking around. Like, you know, where my mom wouldn't know like that I had like a mushroom sticker on my car, like what that meant, where my sister's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you're fucking advertising that you do drugs and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, like, leave me alone. She was onto my bullshit, whereas my parents weren't. And we would fight about that, you know? But then I think there was also this thing of like, we had a little like a mutual respect for each other and kind of like, I think she was genuinely like, look, you're talented, get your shit together. And I was just kind of like, nah, man, I'm just fucking partying. Like, I don't have time for that. So we fought a lot. So when she went on vacation and died, it felt like she just never came home. So that was kind of weird. And then, but when my mom died, I was in the room with her and we talked and everything. And she was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to die now. And then she died.
What did she say to you?
So before she passed away, she was real sick. And I remember telling her like, if this is too much, you know, it's okay. You know, don't try to fight if it's too much. And she like bounced back and was like, oh, I'm okay. Like, I'm not like that. I was like, oh shit. I felt terrible. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I told my mom like, hey, go ahead and die. Like, it's okay. I was like, oh God. And I felt like such an idiot for saying that. And then the next day or 2 days later, we were in her room and she's like, remember that thing we talked about? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, I think I'm ready. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, you don't want to see someone suffer. I'm like, sure. If you're ready, okay. And then that, you know, that was it.
And was comedy and wrestling a way for you to lose yourself in all that pain?
It was before that.
Okay.
It was before that. Because before that, when my parents would fight or my family would fight, there was always fighting. Sunday was always the day for fighting. I don't know if you got when your guys' day was for fighting.
We were more passive aggressive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our day, we were passive aggressive throughout the week, but Sunday
was your binge day.
That was the day for fighting. You better have your room clean, because if not, you're going to fucking get hell. That was, you know, my dad was pissed. And I'd always ask my dad, he's like, I was just depressed that I had to go back to work. And he was depressed that he wasn't at work. He had this weird thing with work where...
A love-hate?
Yeah, really a love-hate. And he was just like, I felt like I needed to be there, so I didn't know how to handle myself at home. And he would only take Sunday off. That was like one of his only day he would take off. And I think he just couldn't handle being home. That caused stress. Him being home caused stress. Him and my mom would get at it. And then my mom would give us shit. And it just like the shit just like rolled downhill. My mom and dad would yell. Then he would leave or isolate himself in the house. And then my mom would be like, well, your room is shit and your grades are shit. And I'm going to tell your dad. And it was like, oh, fuck. And now she's shitting on me. So I would either... you know, go in my room or go down in the basement, and it was wrestling figures, wrestling on TV or comedy on TV, and I could just kind of be like, ooh, all right, that's all I can watch. All in the Family and Sanford and Son, or if there's stand-up on, or wrestling, and I don't have to be bothered by all that. And I learned, even to this day, in my late 30s, I've learned to sort of, you know, sort of those coping mechanisms. And I could live in the worst neighborhoods and be like, well, that's still my restaurant, and I go to the movies there, and I rent movies, you know, back when renting movies was a thing and all this stuff. Or, well, you know, I've got my Netflix, and I'm good. I don't need this and that. I can watch wrestling. I've got my, you know, hobbies that I do. And I've kind of learned to be somewhat content in shitty situations. And that's maybe a good thing and a bad thing.
And you said in the interview that we don't know where it is right now, the lost episode of Marty DeRosa. Hopefully it'll show up, that Eddie Murphy and Andrew Dice Clay were big influences.
Just dirt, like dirty, anything dirty. Movies.
Was your house, you weren't allowed to be dirty and to talk that way?
No, I mean.
What was it about?
I don't know. It was like, I think because my brother was older and he would watch that kind of stuff. And then it'd be like, you got to leave. And I'd be like, well, I don't want to leave. Like, I remember there was some like Rolling Stone concert video or something where there was like the giant penis on stage or whatever. And I remember as a kid just being like, come on, let me stay in here and watch this or whatever. And then like I would always watch those like USA Up All Night movies, like Bikini Car Wash 2 and stuff. And I just, when somebody was like, oh, you got to hear this, and it was like Two Live Crew and NWA, or there at the library you could rent the Andrew Dice Clay tape, like I said. And it was just like, I was just like, fuck yeah, like this, I'm in, this is awesome, I love this. It was always just like, so I don't know, like, ooh, this is bad, we're not supposed to talk like this or talk about these things.
So you're in your 20s, and even before that you're watching all this stuff and liking it.
Yeah.
but when do you start doing stand-up?
In my late, I was almost 30.
And you say that in your late 20s it was basically you just drank your way through your 20s.
That or napped on a couch. Yeah, more not always drinking. A lot of times just like almost like TV was a TV, and just being depressed on a couch was
enough to medicate you.
Yeah.
So how did you get in this depression? How did you get up and start doing stand-up?
I have no idea. I mean, I think like I just, and this was like, I mean, there wasn't this giant comedy explosion like there is right now. So there would be, you know, an article every once in a while in like the Red Eye, or what was the other one? The Red Streak.
Red Streak.
You know, we'd rival free newspapers, or you'd go online and there was like a Chicago comedy blog or something like that. And I was like a lot of depressed people, I love depressed people because I was a depressed person, and I still am, but I was that guy in the back of a comedy show. I know when they're scouting it out. I know when a guy is in the back or a woman's in the back scouting it out. Just kind of like, you're not here to laugh. You're here to observe, to see, can I actually do this? And I did that forever. I would go, because I heard two friends. One guy I went to high school with was like, I'm going to go do an open mic at this comedy club. And I remember me and all my friends being like, what? You're not funny. We're funny. You're not funny. And then this was like in high school. And then in college, I dated this girl who we dated, but we fucking hated each other. Like, we were so competitive. We were in a lot of the same classes. We were like competitive. And we were like, I don't think we really liked each other very much. Like, I think we were very much like, I don't know why we were dating. Cause I don't, like, I really think we disliked each other in a weird competitive way. I don't know. But she was like, this was in Indiana, and she was like, well, I have to go into the city tonight. And this was when Chicago was this, like, forbid, like, whoa, like, almost like you go through a jungle and pull it back, and it's like, whoa, Chicago. Like, it was this wild place. And I remember her being like, I have to go to Chicago. Two of my friends are doing an open mic tonight. And I was like, this fucking thing again, this open mic thing. And I'm like, is this what you have to do? You know, because there were no podcasts where you can hear, like, here's everything you need to know, and I'll let you know whatever you need to know before you even step foot in a comedy club or your first open mic. I can listen to you know, endless hours of comedians talking about this stuff. So I had to learn. I like bought books. I read books. I ordered just anything was like, well, okay, this might be something that can give me an idea of it. And then I finally would go to a show here and there, or, you know, you go in the reader, okay, comedy's going to be at this place. And you'd go, and again, I would be in the back, and I'd be like, all right, that guy sucked. Maybe I can do this. And then someone would go up and be great, and you're like, fuck, I can't do this. 6 months later, all right, maybe I can do this. And then it was like, do an open mic. Oh, okay, I did it.
How bad were you?
Probably horrendous. I didn't like tape it or anything. Probably guaranteed bad because I didn't bring friends or anything. Then I think I did another one. I was like, well, I did it, and I just didn't follow up, like everything. And then I think like I got drunk one time and told my buddies I'll do it, and then we went to one, and I was like, well, it went all right, and your buddies are there, and you're like, yeah. And then I think I went back the next week. And I remember, like, the crowd was just rough. And I remember thinking, like, I'm good at this. I did it last week. I was great. And I remember this other guy, he's like, I'm not going up tonight. Fuck that. And I was like, I'm going up. Kind of like, I got this. And I think they were even like, does anyone else want to go up? Like, we don't have anyone who wants to go up. And I was like, I'll go up. And I just ate all the shit. And I was like, oh, fuck this. I'm out. And that was a big thing back then was, fuck this. Fuck these guys. They're all fucking phony. I'm out of here. I would leave.
In improv, we always say that like a bad show, we learn more than a good show.
Absolutely.
Is that true in stand-up as well?
Yeah.
And what do you learn in a bad show?
That sometimes it's just the show, or no one was going to. I'll say that, like, you know, there's times where I'm like, who would they have wanted? You know? Show me who they would have wanted, you know?
Meaning if Seinfeld was there or Hannibal Buress was there,
sure,
it wouldn't have made a difference.
Maybe, maybe not. But also, too, I'm like, well, in my, you know, I kind of say, like, in this pay grade, like, come on, who would have been? Which one of my friends would have been able to crack them or whatever? What did it need? There's shows I think about now where I'm like, God, if I could go back now with this comedy brain and go back and do that show that I did in Minnesota when I was 6 months in and I felt like garbage. Like, that to me is just like, there needs, it's always helpful when someone can say like, hey, like, don't worry about that. Like, that's a bad show. And that's why in wrestling, they say you learn more in the cars and the bars than you do in the ring. And that's that idea of you're going to learn more stories and hear more tips from these wrestlers hanging out, driving hour after hour to the next show, or hanging out in the bar and talking and, oh, I didn't know that, versus in the ring where it's like, okay, I'm physically doing this thing, but sometimes just talking about it and hearing someone go, fuck that, or here's what you did wrong, it's like, ooh, I love that. That to me is what it's all about. Getting in a car with a bunch of comics, going to a show, some do good, some do bad, some do so-so, and you just talk about it the whole way.
For people who don't know your work, you are an improviser when you get up there.
I think so. Yeah, I improvise a lot of stuff, and I'm definitely not a traditional joke writing comedian.
But you do crowd work.
I like to talk to the crowd. Yeah.
And for people who don't know crowd work, it's basically you go up there and you improvise off people. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little different than just saying like, "Can I get a suggestion?" Or name a occupation. I'll just talk to them a little bit more.
And for people that want to try this, you shared a tip that I really liked on the Lost episode about if you're going to try this crowd work, if you're going to try to have a conversation with the crowd, you had a tip that I think was really helpful.
Just kind of going up, having that first joke loaded, ready to go, but also just kind of talking, and then you'll get to that point where you kind of feel like, okay, now it's time to go into material. And this is all stuff that I've heard from other comics or say this or say that. And I'm like, oh, I like that idea. And like, that seems to suit me well, or I could take that information and kind of run with it. But I think, yeah, it's just kind of going up, knowing a little bit where I want to go. To me, it's kind of like this idea of comedy for me is like, I'm leaving my old house in Indiana and I'm going to Chicago. I don't know where I'm going to go in Chicago, but I'm headed towards Chicago. I'm on 94. I'm heading towards Chicago. You know, I'm not gonna go to the suburbs or anything. I'm headed into the city. It's to me, it's just sort of which exit I'm gonna go, and oh, I'm getting off on here. I'll go here.
And you frame if you do a 45-minute act, 40-minute set is what they say, right?
Yeah.
I want a
headlining set, 45 to an hour.
Yeah.
Sure.
I like to use the terminology like I'm in the know. You will put jokes and stories that you have inside the improvisation of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'll kind of have it where it's some of the sci-fi movies where they can like move stuff with their hands and they're moving the computer and they're putting the puzzle together. That's how I kind of feel sometimes. Or like, not that I'm a genius, but that beautiful mind, how he's like moving stuff and writing. So those jokes are all kind of floating in the atmosphere. And if I'm talking to you about something, I can have the presence of mind to, and I don't know if this is like the ADD that I've harnessed or something, but as we're having this conversation, I can be like, ooh, I'm going to take it to this thing and we're going to slip this joke in here about this. And then I'm going to get him with that and then we'll wrap it up and do this or whatever.
Are there, you know, in improv there's rules. Like, and I say rules, I don't really believe there's rules, but there's concepts. It's like yes and, always agree.
Uh-huh.
Are there things that when you're working, when you're improvising off a crowd, and that's what you're doing, that always seem to work?
I'm in control.
What does that mean?
Like I'm the boss. I'm the conductor. And if somebody is a little too like, okay, I'm going to either dial it back, leave it alone.
What's an example of someone too much? They always want to talk?
Always want to talk. They don't let me kind of like, okay, I've got that information from you. Now I'm going to process it into a joke or into something. And if they just keep going or something like that, that is one thing. Or if they're just... if they're too funny, and it's like, oh shit, they're too funny.
So how do you deal with them?
You got to kind of move on a little bit, and you kind of, or keep them at a distance, or kind of. There's little things where I'm sure there's stuff I do that I don't even know that I do that kind of like asserts power and like, okay, Jimmy, you're all right. You know, hold on, calm down. And it can be as easy as that. I'm just like, all right, I'm the one who's fucking getting paid tonight, not you. Come on, calm down, or like stuff like that.
The other thing that I love about comedians that work this way improvisationally is you have it's almost like an intuition of how the energy of the audience is and stuff like that. How when you see an audience, how are you assessing them every second? How is that?
I think it's like you go up there and then you get that first laugh, whether it's from a joke or just something you say. And I don't know, it's weird. Like, I can kind of hear that laugh and kind of like, oh, okay, it's okay, we're going to have fun. Or like, oh, it's like that, we're not going to have fun. Or, well, we're going to have to try a little bit. Or, oh, man, you guys. Or I'm watching other comics go up and I'm going, oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to get up there. They're so fun. This is, oh, this room is electric. I got to get up there. I cannot wait.
You can tell by the laugh.
Yeah.
The first laugh.
Yeah, you get that first laugh and you're just like, okay. But there's times where I'm listening to other comics go up and I'm just like, oh. Or you're like, this crowd can be, you can get them. They might not have been gotten yet, but like you can get them. And there is that like flipping the room. Like this. I trust me. I know this audience is good. They just need the right like something.
The other thing you said that I liked in the Lost episode, it's very hard for me to let go that it's a Lost
episode.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Is this thing about when you get up there and. You want there's times where you just want approval from the audience, so you're just going to go with your set stuff.
Yeah.
And then the time where you want to take a risk.
Oh yeah, there could be two people who have seen me, and one person could go, oh man, that was the guy who came up and did something weird. Like there was one night in there's a great comedy club in Appleton, Skyline Comedy Cafe in Appleton,
in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and the men's bathroom is right. Off the stage. When you walk off the stairs, you can walk right into the men's bathroom. And one night, I just kept going back in and saying it was my dressing room and just having so much fun with it. And my buddy was hosting, and I kept bringing him back up to bring me back up on stage. And I would, bring me back up. And we did this thing forever. And just so many fun things. And there's other times where I've went there where I've just been like, I'm just doing the jokes tonight, you know? And so it's not always the it's not always like, yeah, we're just going to have fun from the start to finish and improvise everything. There are times where it's just like they just want jokes, you know, and there are those crowds where you're just like, oh, I'm trying to do this fun thing I like to do, but then when I do that, I don't get much, and then when I do, all right, well, here's a joke, and they laugh, and I'm like, fuck, they just want jokes. That's a thing sometimes.
For as you know, improvisation, both for stand-up and when you're doing it, you know, more traditionally, it's disposable.
Yeah.
Has it affected your career? Like, if you came up with five tight minutes for Conan,
yeah,
let's say,
yeah,
would you be farther?
Yes. And if I had more of, like, I'm the guy who talks about this, you right. know, maybe that would help. I don't know. I do know that, like, there have been some sets that I've done that have been really great sets, and I'm really proud of them. And I felt like, man, on this night, like, I'll put that, you know, 10 minutes I did at this show up against any other 10 minutes that was done in the country this night. But then I've also had those. And then friends have gone, oh, that's great. Are you going to submit that to Comedy Central? Like, you're not going to be able to do that on Conan. You know what I mean? Like, there's that thing of like, eh, you're right. Like, it's almost like, you know, I'm in Major League Baseball, and I'm real good at bouncing the ball on my bat, and then I can hit it and I can bounce it in the air, and then, or like the Tiger Woods commercial with the golf club where he can bounce it and then hit it. It's like, oh, you're good at that, but that's not going to win you a tournament.
So what prevents you from coming up with a good 5 or 7 minutes to do on Conan?
Probably the thing that also in the past has forced me to like drink too much when there's like a big or fuck around when there's like a big
tell me a time that you did that where you really
a bunch of like, you know, like a Just for Laughs thing,
which is
or
a
like,
huge, I mean, Montreal, sure, could, you know, sure. You,
Just for Laughs, I've had a couple of those sets where I'm like, oh yeah, I
you got drunk before,
yeah, and didn't take it seriously and kind of shit all over it a little bit, or kind of made light of like, okay, haha, and like, you know, said a couple snarky things or something like that. And I think a lot of that is just being scared. A lot of that was just being scared. And maybe thinking like, oh, you don't like me anyway, so I'll do something where then I can be cool and go, I was the bad boy that night. And like, I don't have to worry about it.
For a guy who's been in therapy, do you look at that as I'm just the bad boy, I'm the rebel?
Or no.
I self-sabotage.
I was scared. I wasn't ready. I knew it. That's the thing too with therapy, that I've sort of gotten to know myself better. And there's things I do. There's people I dated. There's decisions I made. There's stuff I did stand up, and that, where it's like, oh yeah, there's no mystery why I did that or dated that person or acted that way. Like I sometimes try to act, think I'm this mysterious, like, man. But it's like, no, you're very calculated. I know what you're doing. And it's almost like one of those things where it's like, you know, I've had that where I've, like, done mushrooms and looked in the mirror and talked to myself and been like, I know what you're doing, you know. And I think a lot of it was fear, and maybe still is fear. And a lot of it, too, is I've always had this thing where that stuff, that's for other people. That's not for me.
Success? Fame, money,
that
TV,
it
TV
goes
show?
Back to high school, the honor roll, that's not for me. Being good at Little League, that's not for me. It goes back as far as I can remember.
Almost like the other side of the tracks mentality.
Yeah, and I've always had a chip on my shoulder. And
Where'd the chip come from?
I haven't grown up just the way my family was. And also,
were you outcasts?
No, but a little isolated from the rest of our family. You know, my dad was an alcoholic, or is an alcoholic, whatever. Growing up, got sober when I was a kid. And that alcoholic thing of, like, keeping your business, it's your business. That's
secrets.
No one else's business.
All secrets.
And I remember being like, you know, like, we're going to go to Disney World. And I'm like, oh, and they're like, don't go telling everybody. you know, and this whole thing of like, I felt like there was this big thing of like, they think they're better than us, and also we don't want them to think we're better than them. There was this whole weird, we're going to do this thing. Don't tell anybody. That's none of their business. There was always that. That's none of their business. Don't go telling everybody things. And it was like, okay.
I talk about therapy a lot. I'm sure people get tired of it. How does, for a performer, how does therapy help you with your comedy?
I think that there are times where I'm in my therapist's office and I am talking about the drunk guy who ruined my night or the person who wrote a shitty comment on a Yelp review or a comment card or whatever. And it's like, I get bummed out sometimes where I'm like, why am I wasting my therapy time on this bullshit? But then I do realize like, oh yeah, this is my life and this is what I care about. So it does make sense. And I've gotten some of the best advice from therapists and I've gotten some of the, you know, best advice from other comics too. But it's like, I definitely, I feel like where I'm at right now, I'm not bulletproof. I'm not like immune to criticism or, you know, an iTunes review or a person writing on a comment card. Like, they'll get me every once in a while. But there are other times where I'm just like, you know, like I did a show with one of my buddies up in Milwaukee. We co-headlined at this one comedy club. And we were reading the comment cards afterwards. And they're bullshit comment cards. And it's just like such an antiquated thing. But it'll be like, how was your service? How was your service tonight? One being terrible, five being great. They circled five. How was the atmosphere? Five. How was the employee friendliness? Five. How are the comedians? Three or two. It's like, what the fuck? What? Like, what else did you want from us tonight? We had the best fucking show. Like, what else do you want? You know? And that used to send me into a tailspin. Now I would just be like, get the fuck out of here. Your Yelp review doesn't matter to me. I know what we did, and I know, and get out of here.
Have you ever gone into your therapist's office and tried new material?
No, but I have said stuff, and I'm like, I'm going to have to write that down.
Has your therapist ever suggested, oh, you know what, you just said that, maybe you should?
No, I don't think so. Going into sophomore year or whatever,
mm-hmm.
We bought a wrestling ring. We had a backyard wrestling federation, and we put a show on public access. And
when you were in college?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And we loved it, and it was so fun. And we somehow talked to our high school that we had graduated from, that a couple of the other kids were still in the high school that wrestled with us. It was some of my friend's little brother and his friends. We put on a wrestling show at our high school, and my mom didn't go. And I was like, she was just like, I'm not going. I'm not going to go see that. And it was like, damn, I think my dad took my nephew to see it.
But your dad hasn't come to your stand-up?
No.
He's never, and no. Have you ever asked him
he
to come?
He came twice late to a show. He came to two shows late both times.
How did you feel about that?
At the time, pretty bummed out. Now it's just become this weird thing where it's just like, it's almost like a baseball player who's like, I always, you know, wear two socks on my right foot. I don't know if him showing up would fuck me up.
When you talk to him, does he ever ask you how it's going, or does he pretend like you're not even in it?
It's very much like, it's kind of almost like a parent whose kid is in like porn or something, and they don't want to know too much about it, but they're just like, how's work? And they're like, good. And like, all right. Like, that's all I want to know. I don't want to know that you made, you know, Buttfuckers 5. I don't want to know that. I just want to know you're all right. You're doing all right. Okay.
Does he ever say, oh, someone saw your show, a
yeah.
friend or neighbor,
yeah.
and you said this and...
No, but he will say, he'll just say, someone asked him what my show is like, and he's like, it's very dirty. That's what he said. So, I don't know. Mind you, he used to watch BET Comic View every night.
What is it?
BET Comic View.
Okay, which was?
It's just black comics on black entertainment television, BET.
Right, right.
And it's all just like, you know, white people fuck like this, but black people fuck like this. And that was his favorite. So
why do you think he identified with that?
I don't know. I think like he came from a rough neighborhood, and I think he grew up with black dudes, and just that was the kind of humor he liked, and he was just like, yeah, it's funny. We'd watch it together all the time and stuff, and then I'd like dip in and watch with him a little bit, and then go down to my basement, which was my sort of sanctuary, I don't know. I've had like family members or family friends try to say why they think maybe he doesn't come to shows, and maybe it's because like he really has no idea what I do. I mean, he knows I do comedy. I don't even know if he, I mean, he's older. He's 80 now, so it's like I don't think he knows too much about like what a podcast is or anything like that, or he doesn't really know how busy I am or how successful I am or what I'm doing. There's always kind of this idea of like, well, eventually you gotta, you know, get a regular job, or eventually you'll get a real job, right? I mean, I could, you know, be on Conan and I could tell him, and would he watch it? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe not.
Now, you're very successful. I mean, you make your living at comedy.
I would say I've carved a niche. I don't know if I'm successful, but I've carved a niche.
What is your definition?
That's the thing. Yeah, what's the definition?
I want to know your definition of success for you.
For me, right now, my definition of success is to pay my rent and pay my bills through my sort of artistic endeavors, comedy and podcasting.
Right. You don't want to have to wait tables or
yeah.
work.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, and no. I've done that. No. But I also I love my life right now. I love my life right now.
What? Why is it so good? Because
it's my life. I don't have to go to a job that I dread waking up for, which I've done. I don't have to go to a place and act busy, which I've done. I don't have to dress a certain way I don't want to dress, or hide my tattoos, or deal with people who are mean and who don't appreciate the help that I'm giving them. Not that sometimes comedy crowds don't do that either.
But it seems to me like you're making a better living than when I saw you a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. I'm a completely different person than when you saw me a couple of years
What's
ago.
What's changed?
I know myself more.
Through therapy?
Through therapy, through just life, through mm-hmm. mistakes.
Right.
Through the right choices. I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned a lot about relationships and the ones I should be in and the ones I shouldn't be in. I don't need somebody in my life for certain reasons. You know, I don't need...
What are those reasons? Approval?
Sometimes approval. Sometimes feeling like, well, I'm better off than they are. You know, it's weird sometimes. Also... You know, you learn weird things in therapy, like you're dating somebody who's just like your mother. You know, that's the thing, too, where a lot of female comics will be like, or there's this joke about, like, you know, my dad left, so now I date these kind of guys or whatever. And I'm like, same thing with guys dating their girl. It sounds gross and weird. It's like, yeah, that she cried just like my mom would cry for no reason. Like, of course I'm falling in love with this girl. It's such a weird fucking... You know, whatever the female version of an Oedipus complex is or whatever. And
so for those people that are listening to this who mm-hmm. who want to just do comedy and make a living at it,
yeah.
What would you tell them?
It's probably not going to happen, or you're going to live like a college student, which I do, but I'm also okay with that. I grew up...
But you're living better than a college student since a couple of years ago?
Maybe. But I mean... I keep the overhead very low. I don't have a kid. I don't have much, but that's the way I like it. I'm very much like a minimalist in that sense, where I don't need stuff. I don't need, when I moved back from LA, everything I owned was in a bag. I got a bed off of a friend, and that was it.
But isn't this a preparation, Marty, for when you do hit it big?
If I do hit it big... Or when, whatever. I like that speech, when. I'll know what to do with the money. I won't be an idiot. I won't be like, well, I'm going to buy the most expensive car and this and that. I don't need much. And that, to me, has been another thing I've learned, is I don't need much. You know, that was the thing with my dad growing up. He was like, when he was a kid, he lived in a real tough neighborhood in Indiana called The Harbor. East Chicago, real tough neighborhood.
Working class, right?
Working class. And his dad had a European grocery store, Italian grocery store, and they lived above it. And my dad always hated that they didn't have a house. He hated that they lived essentially in a warehouse. You know, he hated that. And he always wanted a house for his family. And that was the thing that motivated him more than anything. And we got a great house when I was born. We lived in a nice neighborhood in Indiana. And the only problem was my dad was never home because he was always working. And we had this talk one day, and we've gotten closer since my mom has passed away. And he was just like, my goal was to always have a house for you guys. And I'm like, yeah, but you were never there. Like, I would have rather had a smaller house and, you know, had him around. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it was better he wasn't around. Who knows? But that was a weird thing to me where it's like, and it kind of hit him. And I saw that hit him. And he was kind of like, fuck. Like, yeah. And his whole thing, too, he used to say, like, he used to think he was going to have a heart attack and die, so he was just trying to make as much money as possible to, like, stash away for us to live off of when he dies, which is fucking morbid. And it made me kind of look at hard work as, like, fuck that. I don't want anything to do with that. Also, with, like, I think my brother got divorced, and he was in a shitty relationship, and that was, like, that was one of the marriages I saw growing up, and I was like, fuck that. I don't want that. I think I looked around at a lot of things, and I was like, I don't fucking want this. I don't want, a house in suburbia. I don't want a marriage that's not fulfilling or looks fun. I don't want to work hard. All these things. At the time, I thought I didn't want to work hard. Then I started doing comedy, and I was working a full-time job, still doing comedy every night, drinking like just tearing it up. Just, you know, I got like all this confidence from comedy, and it was like, wow. And then there's all these girls around and everything. And it just was magical. There was like a span of my early 30s where comedy, you start to get decent enough at comedy where you're not terrible, you know, and you're out with these new buddies every night, and you're drinking and you're meeting girls, and you're just like, it was like the most fun.
I mean, you're a rock star. I mean, are you getting, were women throwing themselves at you, and you could do one night stands?
Yeah. And it was, and it's great. And it's, I mean, it still happens every once in a while where it's just like, oh, okay, this is cool. Or like, you know, that's the thing too, where it's like, you know, there's younger, I mean, I have friends who are my age who don't do comedy, and they're, you know, not likely to meet a younger woman at a bar on a Thursday night because they're home doing, you know, kids or wives or job the next morning and stuff like that. So it's allowed me to live a different sort of lifestyle like that or whatever, which is fun. But then also there's times too where I'm just like, well, I'm alone. I don't have anybody, but I kind of like it. I think I've sort of built the life where maybe it's not the best life for me or the ideal life for me, but it's the life I like living. And there have been times where I think I tried to trick myself, like one time when we crossed paths where I was kind of like, let's try this. Let's move in with somebody. Let's see if this is me. I'm at the certain age. Maybe this is what it should be. And I was fucking miserable. And I was like, nope, this isn't it. And I tried all, I would impulsively, because of my ADD and depression, think like, okay, once I do this, everything will be okay. And then I would do that and I would go, oh, this is even worse. And then all of a sudden that life that you're like trying to escape from, you're like, maybe that's not the worst life after all.
You moved in with her and...
I've done that with a couple girls where I moved in being like, this is probably a great idea. Where all my friends were probably like, what are you doing? And then you get in these relationships or situations and then you're just like, oh, what am I doing? You know? And it's like, you know, you move into that new apartment and it's the first night you lay your head down on the pillow and you're like, what the fuck did I get myself into? And... but because I don't have kids, I'm not married, I can get out of these. You know what I mean? It's like, I haven't been divorced, but I've had like these mini divorces of like, keep all the furniture, fuck it, I'm out of here. And like, I'll pay the security deposit, I'm out of here. You know, I've done those.
So as we wrap this up, Marty, two quick questions. You came back from LA, you uh-huh. went out there for a year.
Yeah.
You had built a name here in Chicago. You go out there, now you're back.
Yeah.
Things are better than ever for you.
Yeah, because I was unbelievably depressed there, and I wasn't able to really do anything.
How does Chicago depression look different than L.A. depression?
That's a good question. I think I was more isolated in L.A. It's a big, giant city, so no one can really keep tabs on you like they can here. If I go missing here, people are like, the fuck have you been? There, it's like, it's too big. No one cares also. You know, everyone's worried about their own shit. I think there's more. I have more genuine friendships here and more people who are going to be like, what's going on with you? And those real good friends who I really depend on and who have been there for me and who motivate me. My buddy Colt.
Colt Cabana, yeah, the wrestler?
He's in a lot of ways, like a great sort of role model or a blueprint of like, this is what you should be doing.
Well, he's an entrepreneur.
He is an entrepreneur, and I learned all that from him. Being friends with him was like going to college. Mm-hmm. It really was.
He majored in marketing.
Well, yeah. And I borrowed his degree then because I've sort of just, you know, in wrestling, another thing they'll do is they'll be like, you know, sit under the learning tree, you know, and this veteran taught me everything I knew, whatever. And in a lot of ways, he taught me so many things that I apply to comedy, podcasting, all this stuff where I'm just kind of like following the blueprint from him, but also other people too.
Well, but there's the other thing, because I went out to L.A. and I wanted to make it. I lasted 5 weeks, Marty. Mm-hmm. You come back and there's a stigma like, oh, you gave up on your dream. You know, you're not going to make it here in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
so what do you say to people who say that?
Well, and this is one of the things we were talking about before, too, where there's certain things people say in stand-up. I don't know if it's the same in improv. I assume it probably is, where they'll say, like, you can't be successful here. Or you got to go to New York or L.A. And I hear a lot of comics say things like, you know, Chicago's a great place because you can, like, take chances and make mistakes and no one's watching and stuff like that. Yet I don't see a lot of these people taking many chances or making any mistakes because they're not taking any chances or something like that. So I kind of think a lot of that stuff people just say because they say it. Also, for me, that path of go to L.A., get on this, go do this, blah, 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 blah. I never thought that was the path for me. And I don't know why I thought, I mean, I know why I did it, because it was an impulsive thing and it was a reaction to a breakup. And it was, oh, you're going to do that? Well, I'll do this. You know, it was reactionary.
You were competitive.
Sure. And what I know now is that I'm not the traditional stand-up and I'm not ever going to have the traditional stand-up career. I've never had a manager for stand-up. I've never had anybody show any interest. I've never had anybody be like, let's figure something out with you. I've never taken a meeting. I've never done any of this shit. And there's comics that I know I'm so much better than who have. And for whatever reason, that's great. Good on them.
So what is your version of success? What would – you've got this stuff going right now, but what is it?
In a perfect world, and hopefully this is what I'm building towards – A very busy stand-up schedule.
Traveling all around the country.
Yeah, but also if I don't want to travel that much, I don't have to.
And you're making $5,000, $10,000, $20,000.
That'd be amazing. But more so, I'm saying I would rather, and I don't need a whole lot of money. If I have a number in my head, if I made that, I'd be like, wow,
what's the number?
I mean, I don't
150?
Know.
150? No. That's my number.
I don't need, I could live like a king off of 50.
Okay.
Yeah. I could live like a king off of 50. But again, it's just me.
Okay. So it's touring a lot?
Having a full schedule, doing fun shows at places I want to perform at.
Clubs that you want.
Clubs that I want, or my own theater shows, or my own rock clubs or whatever, doing my own show, having my own fan base who's there to see me, who aren't just there to see generic comedy, who's like, oh, Marty's in town, let's go see him. And have my podcast be successful and bring in money, which... one of them does. So I just need more money there, more bookings, higher profile bookings. And artistically, I would like to be I'm not the comedian that I think I can be yet, if that makes sense.
No, it doesn't.
I think that there's more in me that I haven't stripped away yet or figured out yet.
How do you know that?
Because I've seen, like, flashes of it, or... I'm like, I wrote that joke why can't I write more jokes like that? You know what I mean? Where it's like, I know I have the acumen to do certain things, and I know it's in there. I just it's a puzzle or, you know, like
a Rubik's cube
where I'm just trying to – I'm not quite there yet, and I'm trying to figure it out. And I would love – and this is, again, just probably that part of me that, you know, some days I was joking around saying, like, I don't know if I want a manager as much as, like, a dad to be like, I'm proud of you. You know what I mean? And it's like
– just to go to your show.
Yeah.
Just somebody
yeah.
to go to your show and be able to talk
my about therapist, my old therapist came to my show one time.
How was that?
It was wonderful. I was leaving the stage, and I see him. He's at Zany's. There's those seats by the door.
And Zany's is like Tony Small.
Yeah, so. And I'm like, oh my God, Don, he was there.
And did you talk to him afterwards?
Yeah.
And what did he say?
He's like, that was great. That was wonderful. It was cool to see you up there. And I had an uncle. My uncle came and saw me at the Improv in Schaumburg. And afterwards, he was like, I can't believe it. You just go up there and just start talking. I can't believe it. And he was so nice, so complimentary. And like that was an awkward time. One time he's like telling my dad, he's like, "Have you seen him? He's great." And my dad was like, "Oh yeah, he's great." And I was like,
"There's a lot of unspoken stuff between you and your dad."
Uh huh.
And then there's almost like I'm picking up like shame from your dad that this is what you do.
I think so, maybe, because I don't think he can like put his finger on it. And I think he'll always ask, like, we'll get in these like not fights, but like I don't know what you call them, skirmishes or something where like. So one of the things that I have with my podcast is I have like a t-shirt store where if you like the podcast, you can go online and you can buy a t-shirt for either Wrestling with Depression, or we've got a couple for that and then a couple for Marty and Sarah Love Wrestling. I was telling him about it and he was kind of like, every once in a while he'll get a little inquisitive and I'll be like, yeah, we had a really good month and we sold a bunch of shirts. And he's like, well, how does that work with the shirts? And I was like, well, there's no – and I kind of know like – I know what he likes as far as like business wise, because he used to have a warehouse and you know, all this stock and merchandise and inventory, and he was in the dry cleaning business, and it was like the margins, it was terrible. It was like, no, you made no money off any of this stuff, and he had to have this giant warehouse and stuff, and I'm just like, oh, you'll love this. They don't even make the t-shirts until someone orders it. And I don't even touch the t-shirts. And I'm thinking in his business mind, he'll be like, that's great. And I'm thinking like, here's something you can sink your teeth into.
We can relate as a father and son.
Yes, because,
I'm throwing you a softball.
Because like when I used to work at Costco and I used to test people's hearing. And I remember he was like probably the most proud ever for that. And he was like, you have a skill, you have a tangible skill that you can do. And he used to always say that, like, get a skill that you can always do and someone's always going to need that. And, you know, the baby boomers are only getting older. You're always going to be in demand. And I was like, okay. And then even though now I'm like, I have a skill. I can do stand-up. I can do it till I'm 100 years old. Like, and he's just like,
and I'm actually going to – I actually get better.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And he's just like, I don't think he buys that. But so I'm telling him this t-shirt story and I'm expecting him to be like, that's amazing. Like, you don't have to have inventory. You don't have to have any of this stuff. They have to pay. There's nobody who's going to owe you money. Like, in his business, he had all these people who owed him money, and they never paid, and they were deadbeats and stuff. Everything's perfect. I get money. I don't have to ship anything. I don't have to have a physical warehouse. I'm waiting for him to go, what a brilliant thing. And he just goes, you know what you should do is when you go to all these comedy clubs and bars to do these shows, you should try to get them to buy t-shirts. You should try to get t-shirts made for them and sell it to them. And I'm like, that's not what I do. And he's kind of saying like, listen, you're going to see Jimmy. You should make improv nerd shirts for Jimmy. And then you get a little taste of that and set him up with a store. And I'm like, yeah, that's not what I do. And we started butting heads. And it was this like, you're not understand. You're like, what, why, what, how are we here? What did we get into this for? Like, I don't understand why we took this left turn. I'm just telling you, this is just one of the things that I do. Yet we're starting to butt heads. We're starting to, and he's just like, well, I'm just saying, if you're in these bars every goddamn night, tell them buy a t-shirt. They can sell it. You can get a couple bucks off of it. And I'm just like, it's not what I do. And then I'm finally just like, yeah, okay, I'll have to look into that.
Oh my God.
Like, oh, you're not going to look into it.
That is enough to keep you in therapy for the rest of your life.
I walked in. I was going to meet a friend. She was working at a bar, and I was going to see her. And I just sat down and I was like, I got to go home. I can't even. I was going to eat there. I'm like, I got to go home. I'm like, I can't even fucking be out right now. I got to go home. I'm so fucking worked up. And then I talked to a family friend about it. And she was kind of like, look, your dad's a certain way. And the shame thing is maybe, you know, I sort of feel like with depression, I just kind of tackled, you know, I'm eating right. I'm healthy. I'm working out.
I'm not really drinking as much.
It's made me feel really good. So the depression part of the everyday, like, huh, that's kind of gone. So now I kind of feel like...
No more suicidal thoughts.
I mean, every once in a while I'll have a thought. And a lot of times there's weird thoughts. Like I said this the other day at a show where, like, the fire department was, like, inspecting a fire escape downtown the other day at this building. And the fire escape was open. And the fire department were on the other side, and I was like, I could scale that whole thing and then just jump off, and that would be it. And I was like, well, that's a weird thought. And then I just kept walking to an audition or something.
Let me ask you this, because we do have to, because I'm way over your time.
I'm fine.
Like, if I joke about suicide in an improv show, or if I'm doing a monologue, suicide, or I talk about we just had a baby, and I you know, my wife and I sat down and we said, you know, what are we doing here? Babies don't bring us joy. Audiences hate it. What am I doing wrong? If I talk about depression...
Either you haven't found the right audience.
Okay.
Or you just have to realize there's the average person is just like, no, man, I'm just not on board with this. The audience that you probably seek is too depressed to come to an improv show to laugh at that joke.
Because I did something. I was in Miami, and I did something where I talked about having our... we just had our baby, Betsy... And when she came out, she was ugly. And babies are ugly. Mm-hmm. And I don't care who you are, they come out ugly. Uh-huh. And so there was somebody in the audience, and I said, who has kids? And I have a kid. Were your babies ugly? No, they weren't. And I got to tell you something. The audience was not on my side. And I'm being honest.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you get it.
Yeah.
You know, people in therapy get it. But why doesn't the general public get it? What am I doing wrong?
I think it's like... you know how you feed a kid, you do the airplane, and meh, got to just find that right way to meh and feed them. There's a way. There's also a way, and I think as comics, we sometimes, especially as stand-ups, I think, like, there's this idea of, like, oh, we're all miserable, we're pieces of shit, we're garbage people. It's like, that's not the way to do it. There is a way, though, to let them know, like, oh, okay, you guys are a little fucked up, and that's why you're up there. I get it. There's ways.
Yeah, because to me, that's why I've always liked your comedy and your podcast, because you're honest. You're talking about things people don't want to talk about.
Yeah, and if you can, I like making somebody laugh at something where maybe they wouldn't necessarily talk about. And I'll ask people, you know, like, you know, more personal and intimate questions. And sometimes people will be like, no, I've never done that. And other times people will be like, yeah, I've done that. And I'll be like, ooh, and everyone will laugh. And the person they're with might go, why are you fucking telling this guy this or something like that? But it's always, to me, it's fun. And if you kind of let them know, like, look, no one's going to reveal as many secrets as me tonight. So you're okay. If you reveal one little thing, you're fine. Because I'm gonna let it all out there. And that's the thing, too, sometimes where I feel is a little weird where if I am dating somebody or I'm going to start going out with somebody or they can listen to my podcast and hear me say stuff or come to a show and hear me do stand up. And it's like they have more information about me than I have about them, which sometimes is okay. Maybe sometimes it helps, but then other times it's like, you know, a little bit, oh yeah, this is what you say you always do. And you're like, ah, oh, fuck, now they're going to throw that in my face.
Well, and then some of it might be an exaggeration.
Yeah.
And it might not be
very much
you
so.
Really are.
Very much so. And that's, you know, or it's like, yeah, I haven't done that in this many years or whatever.
Right.
But
I'm through it. That's why I can talk about it.
But I think that now that the sort of just general depression is in check, I wouldn't say cured, it's in check. Now I'm sort of like, and I talked about this with my therapist. I'm just kind of like, so now what are we going to work on? And it was like, let's work on the relationship stuff. Let's work on the family stuff. I mean, it's all intertwined. Like, you know, clearly I look at relationships the way I do because of family, you know, and the role models I had or the model, the whatever archetypes in my life or whatever was kind of like, okay, that's what that was, and now I feel this certain way or whatever. Because what'll happen is I'll meet somebody. The old pattern was meet somebody, instantly just like, I'm so in love with you. I'm so in love with you. Like, I couldn't even imagine not being with you. Let's be together, and then we get together, and then I'm like, I can't do this. Either I tell myself they're keeping me from really working hard, or there's some reason where I don't, feel like I deserve love or something.
Do you think that's the underlying thing, that you don't deserve love?
Probably, or there's this thing of like, you're better alone. You're safe. When you're alone, you're safe. And it's not like nobody's ever really like ripped my heart out. And that's why I'm like gun shy about relationships. Like there's women in my past who like I've left and then been like, wait, come back. And they've been like, fuck you. No. And I'm like, okay. That's the most of it. I mean, like when I was in high school, I had a girl like break up with me, but like, otherwise I'm just like, if they ever do break up with me, it's because I'm so checked out, I don't care. And then they break up with me and I'm like, all right, cool. You just saved me from breaking up with you. But most of the time it's just like, I'm just like, I gotta go. I can't. And it's like, I have these breakups, and in my, like the last big one, I was like, you can't keep doing this to people. Like, you can't. So now I'm sort of.
So you bottomed out on that?
Yeah. I'm just sort of like, I keep things real casual. Anytime I feel like it's getting anywhere serious, I'm just like, I can't do this. And I don't know. Maybe I'll tell myself, maybe I just need to meet the right person, and then maybe it'll be different. That thing of like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm just like, maybe I've never been in love. Maybe when I meet the right person, I'll go, oh, this is it. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's how it'll be. Maybe it won't be. Maybe, I'll just get to a certain age where I'll just kind of want to like, well, I should probably just hunker down with somebody, But in the meantime, I'm having a great time. And, I've met some pretty awesome people along the way. And
you seem more happy than I've ever seen.
I am the happiest I've ever been. It's a fun life. There might be some people who are like, oh, that's a sad life. But I'm like, I think it's pretty fun. And it's not like a hedonist, like, oh, I get to have sex with whoever I want to have sex with, and I can get drunk if I want to get drunk or whatever. That's not, I don't think the draw for me. The draw for me is that for me right now, I'm not in a position where I'm ready to be with anybody. So I'd rather be single than be with somebody and like the whole time secretly be sort of going to a therapist and being like, when I get divorced or when I break up with somebody for the next relationship, I'm going to be that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm honest with myself in that sense of like, there have been multiple women I've dated where we could have gotten married and it would have been okay, or good even. But like, that wasn't the right ones for me.
We got to wrap this up. We ask the same question at the end of each episode of Improv Nerd. What piece of advice would you give someone starting out in comedy or improv today?
I don't know if like, I was going to say don't be competitive, but I don't know if that's the thing, because I think you should be competitive a little bit. I would say kind of like, I heard this from, I should have said something to him. Tim Allen, the guy from Tool Time or whatever, from Home Improvement.
Home Improvement.
So he's, I just saw him. He was at the Laugh Factory.
You saw him in person.
He did, yeah, he did the 7 o'clock show, and I was doing the late show, and I was like, forgot.
Here in Chicago?
Yeah. Okay. He's a part owner or something like that. Okay. It has something to do with it. But anyway, he did this. He was being interviewed one time, and he's a big racing fan, or a big race car driver himself. And it was this William Shatner interview show. I think it was called William Shatner's Raw Nerve or something.
I remember that.
And they had the weird seats.
Yes.
They sat like,
it was weird,
side to side but facing the opposite direction. It was real weird.
Yeah, it looked like a California house with shag carpeting.
Yeah.
It was modern. It was very weird.
So, and it reminded me of that old SNL at the Love Toilet, where it was like his and her toilet seats that were right next to each other. Uh-huh. It was an old like spoof commercial. But anyway, he was on that, and Shatner asked him something, and it got into the subject of, like, what did you learn in racing that you applied to comedy or whatever, or life? And he said, in racing, you never look in the rear view mirror, because as soon as you do, you're going to wreck. And he kind of said there's a term in racing, or a theory of running your own race. Like, even though there's all these other cars out there, you're running your own race. And I kind of heard that, and I was like, ooh, that's pretty good. And I like that. That idea that, like, I'm not I'm not in a race with any other comic out there, or any other wrestling podcaster out there, or any other guy from Indiana who moved to Chicago, or anybody I went to high school with, or anybody who, you know, is anything like me. I'm my own person, and I'm running my own race.
And the other thing I'd like you just to mention, and you said it in the first one that we lost, was how you're a huge wrestling fan.
Yes.
How you apply what you've learned in wrestling to your comedy.
I think there's so many things of just, like, you know, sort of, you know, like in wrestling, it's you let your work speak for itself, and you know, humble, but at the same time be proud of yourself, and I think there's something to be said about just, like, you know, figuring out what you do. Like, there's all these wrestling lessons I've, like, learned. Like, there was a company called ECW, and they didn't have a lot of money, so they couldn't do all the things that the WWE did. They couldn't afford fireworks, and they couldn't afford, you know, all this fancy stuff. So what they said was, like, their big thing was, like, what can we do that they can't do, which was be a little dirtier, be a little more aggressive, be a little more violent. And the owner, his whole thing was accentuate the positives, downplay the negatives. So, you know, if a guy wasn't a good talker, he was this silent, brooding type. And if a guy was little, you know, just – let's just ignore that. He'll just kick everyone's ass, and he'll be this tenacious pit bull. And you're just like, wow, cool. And there were people there that were successful that when they went other places, they couldn't replicate that. They couldn't recapture that lightning in a bottle because they knew how to do that. So for me, it's one of those things too of, like, what can I do better than other people? That's what I'm going to do. And what sets me apart? It's always been the sort of the style of comedy that I do, you know, and at the time it was, well, I'm not the greatest joke writer. Well, what am I good at? Well, I'm good at being in the moment and improvising and riffing and being loose and crowd work. Okay, let's do that. And I sort of set myself apart from doing that. And, you know, this idea too of just kind of like being consistent and put in the effort, which I've done with my podcast, and I feel like it's sort of finally starting to pay off.
And attack the audience.
And attack the audience. And I mean, that's the whole other part, like we talked about too, about, like, there's certain performers who are just like, you're going on a ride. You don't have a choice. When I come out, all that other shit that you might not have been into, that doesn't matter. You know, and there's guys who there's an awesome Japanese wrestler named Shinsuke Nakamura, and his entrance is cooler than what most guys can do throughout an entire match. And this guy can just come out and is so cool, and you're just like, holy shit. And there's people who just, like we talked about, just getting in a ring, you're like, whoa, this guy's going to be something. And to me, there's just like that atmosphere of you see comics, even comics you don't know, but you watch them go up and you're like, this is going to be good. She's awesome. He's awesome. I can already tell this is going to be good.
Which is interesting because what you're talking about is showmanship. And when I see your act, you're so good at it, there's no sense of showmanship.
And it shouldn't. It should look natural. You know, and in wrestling, the big thing is, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, that is like him. It's just him cranked up, you know, cranked up to 11 or whatever they always say. And that's the same thing too, where it's like, I feel like some people have sort of created these characters, but I think most people who are, it's them on stage. That's who they are.
How different are you here right now than you are on stage?
I think the only difference on stage would be, I would maybe be like a little more silly. I think I'm a little more serious, doing this, but I like, you know, there's other times where I'm doing stuff where I'm very silly. When I do my podcast with, my partner, Sarah, we're very silly. you know? So I think there's time to be silly, and there's time. I love talking about comedy, and I love being serious and talking about comedy, and I love talking serious about wrestling. Like, I can do that forever. And I have people in my life who are probably just like, this is so boring. Why are you waxing poetic about, you know, wrestling? But to me, it's just like, it's an amazing art form.
Marty DeRosa, thank you for re-recording this. I feel I've kept you here forever. I just want to turn over all my shame that I feel about this.
It's okay.
Thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks, Jimmy.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Marty DeRosa, for the first interview and this interview. I really want to thank him. And you know what? It really helped me become a better interviewer because we went through the same questions, and I had to dig deeper. I had to ask him different questions to keep it fresh for him and me as well. Marty, thank you. Thank you so much. I want you to check out Marty and Sarah Loves Wrestling, their podcast. Like I said, it's hilarious. You don't even have to like wrestling. Listen to it. It's so freaking funny. And check out his other one, Wrestling with Depression. It's more of an acquired taste. I love it. And if you're into depression or mental health, it's a great, great podcast. I want to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher, for making me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops, classes, intensives, the Art of Slow Comedy, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog, go to jimmycorain.com. Also, check us out on social media. Our Facebook page, I couldn't get that out, but our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, and like us. Also, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and go to this YouTube channel and subscribe right now. Stop listening and go and subscribe to Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, to the YouTube channel, and you will see clips from the live show. We are lucky to be part of Feral Audio, feralaudio.com, all the wonderful podcasts. Go to feralaudio.com now and check those podcasts right after you've subscribed to our YouTube channel. I got to get going here. I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello. I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, he's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My